Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Pope Francis passed away April 21st. He was the first pope from Latin America and will be remembered for his progressive stances and humble style. And the conclave, the process of electing a new pope, is currently taking place at the Sistine Chapel in Vatican City. Joining us to discuss Pope Francis's legacy and the ongoing conclave is Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. Welcome to All Sides, Marcus.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I kind of thought I was going to have to rewrite the whole entire show this morning. and because I thought maybe there would the vote this morning, there would, being the second vote of the conclave, I thought maybe we'd have a new pope. Were you thinking the same thing this morning?
I was worried. Yeah, I think it's pretty likely we may have a pope today. If not today, then tomorrow.
Yes. So I want to talk with you this first segment about the legacy of Pope Francis. But before we do that, we have to talk about the latest news. So the sequester of the cardinal started yesterday. They've had two votes, correct?
That's right.
And so then do you expect, I think they're on a break right now, but you expect one or two more votes today? Or is it you just no one really knows?
They vote twice in the morning and twice in the afternoon. So my understanding from the Vatican News report was that there were two votes taken this morning, our time, you know, and also, I mean, we're 6 hours behind Rome. And that the black smoke that we saw earlier today means that after three rounds of voting, no one has reached the two-thirds majority. So you're right, the Cardinals are on break, they're going to take lunch, and then we expect there will be another vote around 5:30 Rome time, and then a fourth vote of the day around 7:30 Rome time. So it's possible that by one or two this afternoon, we could know if the next pope is elected on the fifth ballot, which is how it's been since 1958, at least. Otherwise, there will be four more votes tomorrow. And if there's no pope elected by the end of the day tomorrow, then the cardinals get a day off. And then we'll have to talk about what, you know, why the College of Cardinals are so divided.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess we'll see. We don't know how the voting is shaking out. We just know that there's black smoke, not white smoke at this point, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, they're sequestered. So there's no communication inside or outside of the Sistine Chapel. So that smoke is the only indication that things are progressing. But we just don't have someone who's reached that two-thirds majority status yet.
And do they put out the smoke after each vote? Or is it that they took two votes and then the smoke? Or is it after every single vote?
Usually it's after every single vote. The smoke was pretty delayed yesterday, so there were some questions about why the smoke came so much later, and some conjecture about, you know, what could have been the probable cause. It sounds like the cardinal who addresses the College of Cardinals after the extra omnes, you know, the call to send everybody out, that instead of the typical 15-minute address, he went on for 50 minutes admonishing the cardinals to be very prudent in electing a pope that the church needs right now. So it is curious to know why there was only smoke once so far this morning after two rounds of voting. But it's also very early, and we have the most diverse group of cardinals we've ever had in the history of the Catholic Church. And given that diversity, I mean, with so many cardinals from Asia and Africa, and including 10 from the United States, it's probably going to take a while for the cardinals to really put their heads together and figure out who is the pope that the church needs right now. So I'm not at all surprised that we haven't seen any white smoke so far, but I am hopeful that it'll either be by this evening or early tomorrow.
Yeah, I heard on a BBC News report this morning that some of these cardinals have probably never even met each other because just they live in different parts of the world and they don't. It's not like they get together and have a conference very often.
Yeah, there has been some reporting about that, that there are so many cardinals from all over, including Africa and Asia, and that they don't typically have the opportunity to get together. But I do think it is worth noting that because of the synod on synodality that Pope Francis has been convening over the last few years, at least 50% of the cardinal electors have been gathering in Rome over the last few years. So while there are some folks that maybe are a bit more unknown to the group as a whole, I mean, Pope Francis was very intentional about elevating cardinals from all over the globe. 100 years ago, all the cardinals were from Europe. So this is a little bit unprecedented to have this kind of global population of cardinals. But given that synod on synodality, where Pope Francis tried to bring the bishops together to listen to each other and to build a church that's ever more, he described it as an ever wider we, trying to leave no one out and no one behind and to pray and dialogue together. I do have a sense that I would bet at least half the cardinals have a few people in mind, and so it'll be interesting once we do get some more insider reports. If there were early front runners who just couldn't get enough traction to get over that two-thirds point, or if it took a while for the College of Cardinals to really figure out who are the people that who are the main contenders. Because in 2013, when Pope Francis was elected, he was not someone that people often talked about among the Papabile, which is interesting because when Pope John Paul II died in 2005, and there was the conclave that eventually elected Pope Benedict XVI, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the man who would become Pope Francis in 2013, he was among the front runners, and he actually withdrew his name. So that could also be some of what's happening behind the scenes, that maybe there's a lot of support around one cardinal, but he doesn't want to be pope, and he has to tell his cardinal brothers, thank you, but no thank you, and then they have to reset. And so that's why it's helpful to have this lunch break so that they can kind of figure out the lay of the land and where the support is, but also who wants the job.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the conclave, along with the legacy of Pope Francis, with Mark Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. So we'll get into the conclave a little bit more in the next segment, but I wanted to pivot back to the legacy of Pope Francis, which you talked about a little bit right there. What do you think Pope Francis will be most remembered for?
That's a great question and really hard to answer. There are so many things. For example, he's the first pope elected from the global south, being from Argentina. He's the first Jesuit pope. So the Jesuits are very well known, for their system of education that's 500 years old. And usually Jesuits focus mainly on pastoral ministry and education. And so it's very unusual for them to be elevated to cardinals. And certainly, I don't think anyone was expecting a Jesuit pope in 2013. But he really brought that long tradition of Ignatian spirituality to bear on the pontificate. And that was reflected when he was interviewed very early on, and he was asked, who is Jorge Mario Bergoglio, as an opportunity to introduce himself to the world. And Pope Francis said, I am a sinner, which comes out of the first week of the spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius of Loyola. And you saw that throughout his pontificate, that he was a very humble person. He embraced simplicity. I don't know if you saw any of the pictures from his burial last week, but Pope Francis was buried in his black work boots that he wore for 12 years, and you could see they were all scuffed. I mean, the
I
leather
mean, I
had
can appreciate a sensible shoe, so.
I know, but they were so beaten down that they had to like put black shoe polish over where the leather had just been eaten away by, I mean, he worked till he died, and a very different kind of mode of operating as compared to his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, who had very expensive red shiny Prada shoes that he wore when he was out in public. I mean, there were times when the Vatican lost track of Pope Francis, and they would find him just spending time with people on the streets of Rome, drawing near people who were experiencing homelessness, offering them pastoral care and accompaniment, offering them the sacrament of reconciliation if they asked for it. And he actually transformed areas of the Vatican to make room for showers and bathrooms so that people experiencing homelessness would find shelter in the Vatican, and that they would find, a sense of haven, and welcome there. And so that commitment to simplicity and humility, I think, will certainly be hallmarks of his papacy. And I mean, just the way he made people feel. Pope Francis was someone who admitted that he was a homebody, that he didn't like to travel very much. He struggled with pneumonia as a child and actually lost part of his lung. And so he wasn't in very good health. And I don't think when he was elected in 2013, he imagined himself doing very much traveling. But shortly after he was elected, there was a boat that capsized in the Mediterranean Sea trying to get to the island of Lampedusa. And it was full of migrants and refugees, and over 300 people drowned. And he was so moved by just the desperation to make that treacherous journey from Africa to Lampedusa, that he decided he needed to go there and just pray and mourn the loss of life of these people just trying to seek a better life for themselves and their families. And to also condemn kind of what he called the globalization of indifference, the callousness at the state of all the political upheaval and the ecological devastation that was making life unlivable for so many of these migrants and refugees. And he reflected, after going to the island of Lampedusa, how moving it was to see how the powerful impact of his physical presence on this island and what it meant to all these migrants and refugees. And it was kind of this transformative moment for him where he realized that his physical presence really made a difference for other people. And so he went to Manila in the Philippines after a huge typhoon swept through there to try to remind people that I'm with you, God is with you, and to be a person who radiated tenderness. We use the word compassion sometimes as a substitute for empathy, but compassion comes from the Latin word to suffer with. And certainly, I think Francis was someone who really took that seriously. He went to the border between the United States and Mexico, and he celebrated Mass with a wood that was made from one of those boats that was trying to make it across the Mediterranean Sea, where he lamented that these are treacherous journeys and thousands of people are dying simply to find peace and a way of life for their families, and to try to condemn the people who are building walls or closing their eyes or covering their ears at these wails of human suffering, and asking people to draw near the people who are suffering, like the Good Samaritan in Luke's gospel, to respond to people with that tenderness, and to try to overcome these binary ways of thinking of us and them. Over and again, Pope Francis kept saying, there is no them, there is only us. And you saw this, for example, not only after visiting Lampedusa or the US-Mexico border, but in 2014 and 2015, he called together a synod on marriage and family life because he wanted to hear from married couples and parents with young children and people, just trying to make a life, and how challenging that can be right now. The Catholic Church describes the family unit as the first and vital cell of society, really believing that as families go, so goes society. And it was really moving to see so many families talk about how they don't feel well supported by the church, or they feel shamed or shunned if their church doesn't, or if their family doesn't conform to particular church teachings. And this is where Pope Francis really started to listen more carefully to LGBTQ Catholics and to understand how church teaching was leaving them wounded and feeling unworthy, or that they couldn't attend church or receive sacraments. That there were LGBTQ Catholics who were worried about losing their jobs if they worked in a parish or in a school, and then they couldn't provide for their family. And so you really see in Francis's legacy a commitment to listening to people in the church, including those who have been hurt by the church. He met regularly with transgender Catholics to hear about their experience and how they came to understand what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God exactly as they are. He met with survivors of clergy sexual abuse very consistently. I mean, almost monthly, he was making a commitment to hear just how people felt cast aside, and rendered insignificant or invisible or powerless by the church and its leaders. And he made it a deep commitment of his to bring reform to the church. And that's hard work because the church is this global institution. It's 1.3 billion members strong. It's 2,000 years old. And so even though he had this deep personal commitment to practice mercy and to remind people that God's identity card is mercy and that mercy is who God is and what God wants, he also had to do kind of the long, hard work of changing the systems and structures that are just very slow to change in the Catholic Church.
We're talking with Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. He's staying with us. And after the break, we're going to talk more about the conclave process and the cardinals who are in line to possibly become the next pope. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. The conclave is now in its second day. It's the secretive and structured process that will determine the next pope. And we don't know if today is the day that we'll see the white smoke rise from the Sistine Chapel. Yesterday we saw black smoke. This morning we saw black smoke, meaning a decision has not been made. Joining us to discuss the conclave process and the cardinals who could become the next pope is Naomi D. Anda, associate professor and executive director of International Marian Research Institute at the University of Dayton. Welcome to All Sides.
Good morning, and thank you, Amy.
And still with us is Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. Thanks for staying with us, Marcus.
My pleasure.
So, Naomi, we talked at the very beginning of the show that this morning I was, you know, waiting to see what color smoke it would be to see if we'd have to write a completely different show right now, right? I'm sure you were thinking that as well. Can you give us a quick summary of how the conclave process works? How many cardinals are in there? What is the majority? Just give us a summary of what's happening right now in the Sistine Chapel.
Sure. So right now we have a number of, so first of all, they went into the conclave yesterday afternoon, Rome time. There was a mass celebrated in the morning, and then they went in to the conclave, and they are in there for as long as possible. As long until we see white smoke and a new pope is chosen. There's 135 of them who are electors, and we need a two-thirds majority for them to be able to reach a decision of someone who is elected pope. Usually that is said to remain secret. So right now we know nothing other than the smoke which arises. And this morning I was very surprised. So then they go in. One of the fun facts I learned early this morning as I was waiting for the smoke at 4 a.m. local was that the chimney is made for the conclaves. I thought it was like a permanent fixture at the Vatican, but they actually make it out of two different ovens or burners, and one has the color, chemicals that are used for the colors. The other one has the ballots, and they seemed to burn differently this time. So we had black smoke for a long time, and then after a little bit of no smoke, maybe just a minute or so, suddenly some white smoke arose, which seemed to be just some final burn off. But I was watching Vatican News, and people seemed so excited to see the tiny bit of white smoke, and then it just dissipated.
Now, do you know how long this tradition of the conclave has been happening? I mean, is it does it go back decades, centuries? How long have we been doing this?
So, it started with a conclave. It started as a tradition when there had been no pope chosen by the cardinals back in the year. It was about 1000. It might have been 1035, and so it's been going now for about a millennium and almost. And we have been the reason it started was because the cardinals had not chosen a pope, a successor, for years. Now, I have found information that says 2 years. Some information says 3 years, somewhere in the span of 2 to 3 years. And so then somebody decided from the local community that they were going to lock up the cardinals. So conclave is really from the Latin conclave, or Spanish, which I speak, con llave, meaning that someone has the key. And so someone forced all the cardinals into a room, gave them bread and water, and said, "You will not come out until you have reached decision." And they locked them in from the outside. So that has changed. And now they lock themselves in. And it's much more of just a general tradition. And they have more food than bread and water now. But that's how long it's been going. And that's how the tradition began.
Now, many people were exposed more to the conclave because of the movie Conclave that came out in October of last year. It was a tense thriller that explored the complex relationships between cardinals. Here is just one short example of an argument between two cardinals that were played by Ralph Fiennes and Stanley Tucci.
If you want to defeat
Defeat.
Tedesco.
This is a conclave, Aldo. It's not a war.
It is a war. And you have to commit to a side.
So, do you think that the way the conclave process was depicted in that movie is an accurate representation of how things unfold in real life? I mean, I know we don't really know how they talk to each other in there, but what did you think whenever you saw them, whenever you heard of the movie Conclave?
So I saw the movie, liked quite a bit of it. I think it had beautiful cinematography, just as a commentary on the movie. Of course, it's made more dramatic to keep our attention for the amount of time that it takes to watch a movie, but I do think there are some things happening. One of the things that happened prior to this conclave is that because there are more cardinals than there have ever been historically, they had gatherings to, because they did not know each other, they had gatherings to come to know each other better. And then they created a list of the qualities they would like to see from the next pope. And I wonder if maybe a scene kind of like the one we just heard happened in that time, but I'm not so sure it would get so dramatic at the point of saying a war. The Catholic Church is also a huge institution, a huge global institution. So some things may change, but it's very difficult to change and move one institution by one person.
Marcus Mesher, professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University, I want to bring you back into the conversation to know what did you think about the a dramatic movie, a tense thriller being made about the conclave? What did you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because it shows that people are really curious about how the Pope is elected and what does it mean to be at the levers of power in terms of who gets to decide and what really matters and what people are looking for. You know, as Naomi said, there was certainly a lot more drama in the film Conclave than I expect what's happening right now. These are all churchmen. The cardinals that have been elected by Francis were chosen because they were shepherds who smelled like their sheep. that was really important to Pope Francis. He wanted cardinals who were good pastors, who spent time with their people, who listened to them, and who tried to respond with mercy. And so I imagine, you know, the cardinals who are gathering right now in prayer and discernment and in discussion, they're really trying to be as attentive and responsive to the needs of their flock as they can. And they're trying to discern who is the right person for the job, who can, you know, try to be attentive and responsive to the needs of, you know, Catholics worldwide, which, you know, with 1.3 billion Catholics around the globe, you can imagine there are so many different needs, and the range of urgency or acuity is pretty great. And so it's a tough job. In fact, when the next pope is elected, he will be brought into a room called the Room of Tears to be vested in the papal alb. And it's called the Room of Tears because this is a really taxing job. Not everyone wants this job. You know, there are huge expectations, not only from every lay Catholic, but from people all over the globe. You know, when Pope Francis was Pope, he was routinely described as one of the most admired leaders in the world, and someone who seemed to have a lot of integrity, who was willing to call other leaders to account. And so I think that's a tall order to find someone who can have good pastoral sensibilities, but also who can be a leader on a global scale.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the conclave process with Naomi D. Anda, Associate Professor and Executive Director of the International Marian Research Institute at the University of Dayton, and Marcus Mesher, a Professor of Christian Ethics at Xavier University. Now, Robert Harris, the author of Conclave, which is the book that inspired the movie, he was interviewed on CBS Sunday Morning talking about his view of the conclave.
It's not that I'm a kind of, you know, seer in some way. It's just that the conclave always falls into roughly this pattern. There are traditionalists and there are reformers. There are geographical blocks. And out of this mix, a compromise candidate emerges.
And Naomi, would you agree with what Harris said there, that there's going to be conservatives, there's liberals, and they're going to find a compromise candidate?
So, first of all, I think how we may think about conservative and liberal here in the USA may be different between traditionalists and reformers theologically, one. Two, I think it depends on the issues as far as what reform is considered and what moving with tradition looks like. So things like the question about women and women's leadership has a whole lot of different angles, and where people may have thought that Francis was going to move very far forward on that, there were no actual theological huge changes made in that vein. And he even said the question has not been matured enough on women's ordination. And now it seems that leadership and ordination has been split. That's just one example. Whereas other people are completely opposed to that. And then other people are, some of the other cardinals are pro women's ordination. That number is far fewer. So I think it's going to be someone who has a mixed understanding of this and someone who is more moderate or central. But I do think the one thing is that they will be more pastoral. They'll lean to be more pastoral. We joke here in my office as we've been preparing things that the cardinals that Francis chose, when you see their pictures, you can pick them because they have this very congenial smile for the most part in their headshots. And so they're very warm and welcoming from the beginning. And looking at some of the things that the cardinals decided of what was needed from a new pope, the top things were mercy, synodality, and hope. And so it's really someone who is focused on those roles and how they would then carry that out. But my source actually says that is the top one, then I think it would need to be someone who is, one, very pastoral, and two, maybe may lean more toward a reformist side, even if it's just from a pastoral edge, not a theological change, big doctrinal kinds of moves.
Now, I heard, I think it was an NPR story, I heard them talking about how it is very frowned upon at the Vatican to bet on who the Pope is going to be. But obviously here in America, you know, we have betting going on about this. Not that I'm going to make you predict the future, Naomi, but who do you think a front runner is for this new to be the new Pope?
Oh, I didn't want that question, but it's okay. Everyone wants to ask it. I've been able to hold my cards until this moment.
Well, you're, yes.
I will, it's okay. I will do it. For a long time, since I first met him, years ago, when I first met him, I thought this man could be an amazing pope, and that is Luis Antonio Tagle of the Philippines. I think he's just amazing, very theologically balanced and incredibly pastoral. We've seen lots of social media posts of him dancing and all kinds of things, engaging with people well. However, since the meetings of the cardinals have started, and especially the last couple of days. Now, I don't know if this is really my prediction, but my hope more so, and this is someone who really I think is far more reformer, is Timothy Peter Joseph Radcliffe. I think it would be wild if he was chosen, really, but he has become my favorite candidate for reasons that he has continued to wear his habit while everyone else is wearing cassocks. And so there's something about him that just seems to have that side of humility. He has strong studies in spirituality and a very strong pastoral presence.
Where is Radcliffe from?
Oh, sorry.
That's
he
okay.
is actually right now in, he's in England.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't know exactly where.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, I just was wondering what continent we're talking about. You know,
oh,
I
he's could definitely from Europe, but
yes.
he's from England, so I don't know.
Well, with the last name Radcliffe, I could guess that, but I didn't want to assume. Yes. Okay. And Marcus Mesher from Xavier University. Same question to you. I don't know if you're a betting man, but who would you like to see as a front runner here for the next Pope?
Yeah, I'm definitely not a betting man. There's a saying in Italian, the cardinal who enters as pope before the conclave leaves the conclave as a cardinal. Mm-hmm. You know, that the front runners almost never end up getting elected. You know, that the cardinals can be turned off by people who are trying to lobby or, you know, there's just, I think, some resistance to having an heir apparent. And so I am reluctant to name anyone that I think it will be. I mean, I think Naomi offers a good possibility. You know, Cardinal Tagle has been called the Asian Francis. And, you know, Pope Francis said that he wanted a church that was more like a field hospital after battle, going out to tend to people's wounds, and less like a fortress. And Tagle certainly has done that very well. But there are some questions about how he's handled clergy sexual abuse in the Philippines. And when he led Caritas in International, it wasn't clear that he really had the management skills that are necessary. And that's tough. That's what I was talking about before. To be a good pastor and to be a good manager, it is rare to find those qualities in one individual. And we saw, for example, with Pope Benedict XVI, he was a brilliant theologian. I don't know that many people would call him very pastoral, but he was an awful manager, and there was terrible corruption in the Vatican, and the Curia was being mismanaged. And that was one of the reasons why he resigned in 2013. He saw that he wasn't up to the job and that people were taking advantage of his inability to manage people and hold people accountable and the lack of transparency. And so it will be interesting to see if we can find someone. You know, for example, a lot of people have been describing Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State, as a front runner, because he has those management capacities. I'm not sure that he has the pastoral dimension that a lot of people are looking for, unlike, for example, Cardinal Zuppi of Bologna, who has done an amazing job trying to draw near refugees and migrants and spending a lot of time promoting outreach to the LGBTQ community. I think, as Naomi said, we may see a compromise candidate just because there are, 72 different countries being represented in this conclave, and they all see very different needs. And so there might not be one dream cardinal, but someone who says we can find, they have to get to 108 votes to get to that two-thirds majority. And so they might find someone who they can say, all right, we're happy enough with this compromise candidate.
And Naomi, a lot was made in the movie Conclave about whether or not the next pope should be Italian. And there was phrases said in it that it's been far too long since there was an Italian pope and they wanted to bring things back to Italy. Do you think that that's a conversation at all? I don't know how long it's been since there's been an Italian pope. Or is the church trying to be more global? And you think that it won't be an Italian pope?
So someone asked me, do you think Francis was really just an Italian pope born on a different continent? And I think that's such an interesting perception. So I think the question about being Italian and the pope coming from Italy is still a very strong question, and maybe part of the conclave. And some of our leaders that have been reported by different media outlets as quote unquote leaders, but we never know because Catholics really do believe the Holy Spirit is in there doing the Holy Spirit's work among the cardinals. So I think it's part of the conversation. I'm not sure if that's going to have an emphasis in the outcome. And the question about people saying, well, was Francis really just an Italian pope born in Argentina? Which I would say no, I think he was different. And again, my hope is that there is a much broader understanding of Catholicism, even though I named a European candidate. My hope would be that actually someone outside of Europe would be chosen.
And there's never been a pope chosen from, has anyone ever been a finalist from the United States? Has that ever been considered?
I don't think so. Okay. I am pretty, well.
Well, we don't really know
we're
who's
not
a finalist.
To
yeah.
really know.
I know, that's true.
Out there. And it has been reported on Wikipedia and other places as diaries have been leaked. So we don't know for sure. There, one of the pieces that's interesting is that there has been at least one top contender from the United States that has arisen, not so much that.
Are you talking about Cardinal Prevost?
Yes.
Yeah, he could be interesting. I mean, he's from Chicago, but he has spent so much time in the Middle East that he could not just appear like an American pope.
Well,
I think, yes, he has a really interesting background.
We've been speaking with Naomi D. Anda, Associate Professor and Executive Director of the International Marian Research Institute at the University of Dayton. Naomi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
And Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University, is staying with us. And coming up, we're going to talk more about the diversity of representation within the cardinals and how that's grown under Pope Francis. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Since Pope Francis passed, there has been much talk about his legacy and whether his way of life will be reflected in his successor. His papacy focused on social justice, outreach to the marginalized, and a more inclusive and merciful Catholic Church. We are continuing our conversation about the cardinals and how the diversity and representation of the cardinals has grown under Pope Francis. Still with us is Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. Thanks again for joining us, Marcus.
Thank you for having me.
So when Pope Francis was elected in 2013, the conclave that elected him was made up of cardinals from 48 countries. Now there's at least 70 countries that have elector cardinals. Do you think the church will continue to expand and diversify its cardinal body, or is how many cardinals is too many cardinals?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Amy, because there was kind of an unwritten rule that we shouldn't have more than 112 cardinals. And Pope Francis went way past that. I mean, he elevated 108 by himself. And I think that was part of his commitment to really embrace the global nature of the Catholic Church, as Naomi kind of alluded to. When people were curious, is Francis really the first pope from the global south, since he was a descendant of Italian immigrants? Is it fair to say that? But he was so deeply rooted in his experiences of sharing life with the poor, taking public transportation in Buenos Aires, that he was really dedicated to elevating cardinals from the global south in particular. So, for example, we have 18 cardinals now from Asia, 17 from Africa. I think this is also not just a point of emphasis by Pope Francis, but a signal that this is appropriate, given that this is where the Catholic Church is growing the most. And, for example, it may be that one of the compromise candidates that comes out of this conclave is Cardinal Turkson from Ghana. He was the primary source for writing Pope Francis's 2015 encyclical Laudato Si on the environment. And although Cardinal Turkson might be a little bit more theologically conservative than Pope Francis, he has a deep commitment to the poor and to the environment. And that's really informed by his experiences in Ghana and all over Africa, where, you know, the plight of the people is shaping his theology and his pastoral priorities. And so that's, I think, what the church needs now more than ever. And I imagine that this diverse college of cardinals will likely go outside of Italy and hopefully outside of Europe and say that we are embracing that this is a truly global religion and not just a European religion with its main outpost in Rome.
In the movie Conclave, Ralph Fiennes' character, Cardinal Lawrence, gives a sermon about his hopes for the new pope, and he touches on the importance of variety in the church.
God's gift to the church is its variety. It is this variety, this diversity of people and views, which gives our church its strength. And over the course of many years in the service of our mother, the church, let me tell you, there is one sin which I have come to fear above all others. Certainty. Certainty is the great enemy of unity. Certainty is the deadly enemy of tolerance.
And Marcus, do you think that speech that was given by Cardinal Lawrence, do you think it was inspired by Pope Francis and his belief about variety in the church?
Yeah, that's my favorite part of the movie Conclave. I mean, it's just such a beautiful way of talking about how we have to celebrate the diversity that's written into the human experience. And this is not only echoing the, you know, central themes of Pope Francis and his call to practice a culture of encounter, you know, to see the divine in every person that we meet and to try to be a representative of the divine for every person we encounter. But it's also deeply biblical, you know. For example, you know, everyone knows the golden rule to love your neighbor as yourself. But in the Hebrew scriptures, the command to love the stranger, the widow, the orphan, the people who had no security or status, That's repeated 36 times, many more times than the, you know, the command to love your neighbor as yourself. With there's this special preference and priority for those people who are pushed to the margins, who are made to question if they matter or belong. And so, you know, for example, in Paul's letters to the church in Corinth, he talks about the church as a body with many members, and that, you know, no part of the body can denounce or lament or look down on any other part of the body. And in other letters, he talks about how in the church, there's no longer Jew or Greek, male or female, enslaved person or free person, all are one in Christ. And so I think that's a beautiful line for us to remember right now, not only for the church, but the world, especially in a time when, you know, there's the demonization of DEI and people really feeling like we're politicizing diversity, when in fact it's just part of what it means to be human. There's no one way to be human, and it's not something that we should merely tolerate. We should celebrate the richness, to be reminded that that every person is created in the image and likeness of the divine, and not to move either towards certainty, as we heard in the clip, but also not to move in the direction of uniformity. And that's what we saw in Pope Francis, this celebration of dialogue, of inclusion, of trying to listen and learn from and with one another. We have so much to learn from one another.
Now, in keeping with how things have been going, maybe tonight, sometime today, you know, our time, or tomorrow morning, we may find out that there is a new pope picked. We may see white smoke, you know, within the next few hours or at least by tomorrow. What happens after a pope is selected? After we see the white smoke, what happens next?
So they're brought into the Room of Tears and they're vested. Then they get to address the crowds gathered in St. Peter's. You might remember, actually, in 2013, before Pope Francis addressed the crowds in the plaza outside of St. Peter's, he actually asked the people gathered to pray for him. And instead of standing on this podium and you know, trying to make himself look big over everyone, he rejected that and he took this posture of humility. And so I imagine there will be some kind of greeting, you know, just to give reassurance to the faithful. When Pope John Paul II was elected in 1978, he said, "Do not be afraid," because he was the first non-Italian pope elected in, you know, like 400 years, and people were shocked that a Polish pope had been elected. So it will be really interesting to see whoever is elected, what their message will be. You know, how will they try to instill hope in the lay faithful? And I'm sure it will include a request for their prayers.
Now, in the first segment, when I asked you about Pope Francis's legacy, you talked very affectionately about Pope Francis. Did you feel that same affection for previous popes in your lifetime, or did Francis really stand out for you?
Yeah, I think every pope has his own charism. Pope John Paul II was wonderful about engaging young people. He was kind of dubbed the rock star pope because he would travel around the world for World Youth Day. And there were just these huge crowds of people who were drawn to his charisma and his deep faith in Christ. I mean, he was responsible for a lot of people really feeling proud to be Catholic again. And in Pope Benedict XVI, he didn't have that charisma, but he was such a deep theological thinker that when you read his writings, you know, he has these beautiful books on Jesus of Nazareth, on the Eucharist, and you could just see how strong his faith was, and to appreciate that this isn't an unthinking faith, or it's not just merely about piety. It really is about, you know, trying to unite faith and science, and to unite the head and the heart. And with Pope Francis, I think his gift was he was just such a great pastor. I appreciate that you heard the affection in my voice. I do feel very deeply affectionate about Francis. I'm still mourning his passing. I'm the product of 14 years of Jesuit education, and I get to teach at a Jesuit university. And so it was so special to have the first Jesuit pope. You know, at Xavier University, we try to educate our students to practice cura personalis, care for the whole person, and to be people for and with others. And we saw that in Pope Francis. And so I imagine that, you know, the next pope will hopefully be kind of the best of the previous three. And in that, I hope we have someone who has charisma, someone who is a strong theological mind, but also someone who really affects people and reaches people on an effective level, especially those who are made to question if they matter or belong, and to remind everyone that we belong to each other.
Now, we only have about a minute left, but in the early years of the Catholic Church, many popes were named saints after they died. Over time, that became more rare. Do you think that Pope Francis will be named a saint?
I do think it's likely. I think we'll have to wait and see. There have to be two miracles attributed to him. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any currently, but I was just in El Salvador with Xavier students down in El Salvador over spring break, and we got to see where Saint Oscar Romero lived and where he was killed. And it is amazing to see all of the medallions and papers and signs that attribute miracles to Saint Oscar Romero, who was assassinated in 1980. And so I imagine if there are that many miracles attributed to Romero in such a short amount of time, it won't be long before we hear that people have prayed for Pope Francis's intercession, and perhaps we will find more good news about the work that he continues to bring about in the world as people pray for his intercession.
All right. That was Marcus Mesher, a professor of Christian ethics at Xavier University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.